Hello, and welcome to our episode of the SAS Space Power Discussions. To begin, all opinions expressed here are our own and not necessarily representative of the Department of Defense, the Air Force, or any other affiliated organizations. My name is Major Alex Yeti Flory. I am a U-28 pilot and weapons officer coming from AFSOC requirements, specifically ISR and strike requirements. I'll turn over to my co-host to introduce themselves.
I'm Brian Goodman. I'm an orbital warfare officer in the U.S. Space Force.
Thanks, Yeti. Nick Underwood, go by Badger, U-28 pilot. Most recent assignment was Doctrine, man. I'm happy to be here today.
Yeah, me too. And so today we're going to be talking about the politics of space security, strategic restraint, and the pursuit of national interests by James Clay Moltz. We're going to cover a lot of ground here, but generally speaking, we're going to cover a summary of the book, some of the major points that Moltz makes, our own personal critiques, connections to other literature we've read in SAS 665 Space Power, as well as the wider curriculum, and then any sort of key takeaways we want you to walk away from after we conclude our discussion. So I'll start us off today getting into the summary of Moltz's book. So Moltz has this puzzle that he's trying to solve, which is why have we been so restrained militarily in space when in other arenas that has not necessarily occurred? He breaks his book into three sections. Part one, he starts explaining space security, his concepts and its comparisons, and he opens up leading in with the four leading explanations, as he calls them, for space theory and space development, if you will. But Brian, I'll turn it over to you to discuss those.
Yeah, so Moltz walks through four schools of pre-existing thought through which he bends the discussions that have historically occurred that he gives an account for in the rest of his book. The first existing school of thought is space nationalism, which sees space is an extension of terrestrial sovereignty and an arena of competition. It tends to emphasize strategic advantage, national sovereignty, and a zero-sum approach to space where power increases by one actor necessarily produce power decreases for another. The second is a view of technological determinism. This view holds that technology itself is the driver of behavior in space. And as systems get more advanced, they enable either competition or conflict, typically independent of whatever policy desires or intent a state has. And that can be for positive or negative. There's an element of path dependence that if you buy military technology, then things are going to trend towards conflict. If you don't do that, then things will tend towards cooperation. The third is social interactionism, which says that behavior in space emerges from the ongoing interaction and mutual signaling amongst actors. There's throwbacks here to a tacit bargaining that we discussed in the cyber theory. Of course, this fundamentally is a constructivist model that aligns with ideas of restraint. They become instantiated as habits, even among rivals, through repeated cooperative engagement. And then finally, we've got global institutionalism, which says that it's the institutions and the legal regimes that constrain state behavior and emphasizes the determining role of treaties, norms, and multilateral forums as a means of enforcing standards of behavior.
Thanks, Brian. So after Moltz sets that stage, he then moves on to his addition to these frameworks, which is based around not just the politics and the technology that lead to cooperation and military restraint in space, but the environment of the space domain itself and how states can learn or unlearn lessons, which then in turn affect their overarching decide to cooperate or compete. Badger, do you want to break that down a little bit more for us?
That is kind of the central thesis of his book. While he goes through these different thoughts and they ebb and flow throughout chronology of the book, he attempts to tease out this idea that the environment is a strong restraining factor itself. And it kind of moves away from the typical perspective we see in this type of literature where the focus is mostly on the states and interstate rivalry, interstate cooperation, the nationalistic approach. So he pulls the environment out itself. And if I could turn a phrase on that, we're frequently saying that if you're a hammer, everything looks like a nail. But then I could also say, from Moltz's view, if you only look at nails, the right tool always looks like a hammer. So by pulling out the environment and saying, how does the environment or the effects of our actions in the environment change the way in which we interact with it? By doing that, it allows us to get after this problem a little bit differently.
With that in mind, as you mentioned the chronology, he uses history as his key piece of evidence, and he starts with the roots of the U.S.-Soviet space race back in the 20s, pulling that forward into the Eisenhower administration and the start of the space competition with the USSR and that environmental learning that you talked about as we started to do some early testing. And then he starts to walk through time to the present. So he talks really the detente period, the early Kennedy administration into the start of the Ford administration, talking about how that produced a lot of the global institutionalism that he was talking about, like the five big space treaties to include the Outer Space Treaty. It moves into some of the challenges that come to that new institutions that have been resolved. So Ford administration moving forward into Bush Senior. And then he starts to move into more into the present as he starts to talk about the uncertainty that kind of gets confronted by the Clinton administration. So a little bit of space nationalism mixed with some social interactionism. And then he gets into George W. Bush, where he says, hey, we lean much more towards the space nationalists, much more competitive. And then as he starts to get into the, more of the present U.S. administrations, the Obama administration, and they really just wound up becoming social interactionism because they struggled to get any sort of actual advanced norms or policies. And then as we started to move into the first Trump administration and that push back towards space nationalism, as you will. And then he revisits with his conclusion, which I do want to hit just a little bit here. His emerging issues is one of the big things that he talks about. So space traffic control, space situational awareness, and radio frequency crowding and geo-slot allocations is what he sees as his three big issues in the space environment going forward. And then he offers his reassessment and maybe some predictive power of the four schools of thought, again, which we'll talk about a little bit more as we move forward. But again, he's heavily leans towards social interactionism and global institutionism, really, as he says his current trends, which is really his big kind of foot stomper at the end, is there's going to be no better way to achieve space security outside of cooperation, and that both unilateral and collective cooperation are available. But the question is where the line on military restraint is going to be drawn, and that the conversation is becoming more global as we're starting to have more players into the space race, both states and the commercial non-state actors. And he sees it leaning towards restraint right now, but he's afraid that it could move in the other direction, which again goes back to his big problem purpose about creating restraint in military space. But before we move on to maybe some of our critiques and connections, are there any other major points that you guys want to flesh out or maybe dive in a little bit more on?
Yeah, I would just point out that one of Moltz's major points that I really appreciated was his emphasis on how strategic restraint was directly linked to the environment of the space domain and the political milieu that was occurring at the time, especially, again, his historical analysis. He talks about how the space security dynamics depend in a fundamental way on the nature of the space environment, and that the technical factors of space created incentives for restraint, specifically like space as a global commons, the fact that space is mutually interdependent, and the fact that the technologies that the U.S. and the Soviet Union were manifesting at the height of the Cold War were stabilizing technologies for treaty verification. I really like when he says that the technical factors, like the ones I just discussed, created the incentives for restraint, and the political processes allowed that restraint to move forward cooperatively. And I think he does a really solid job analyzing the U.S.-Soviet relationship in particular and how the incentives and dynamics of that relationship in that context led towards cooperation and security.
You know, he's trying to pull this environmental factor out and is technical, as you're saying, but the interaction between the two of them, I think, is important to note. So he's not saying the environmental is the dominant factor. He's showing the interaction between those two. And if we can kind of give a case study of the Cuban Missile Crisis. And so during this time, we have Khrushchev and Kennedy trying to come to terms with how do we stop the polluting of the environment? How do we stop the space debris? How do we stop the radiation that's happening? But also they want to stop this arms race that's continuing and growing. So there's lots of nuclear tests taking place and it's damaging the overall environment. Now, how that is damaging the environment is not so much a let's just try to keep the Earth clean. It's actually damaging other satellites in space. It's damaging the ability to communicate. So from the U.S. perspective, it's damaging the other ISR satellites. And those ISR satellites are enabling the U.S. to know what the buildup is in the Soviet Union. He used a case study of the Cuban Missile Crisis that really pulls this forward. When the missiles are put into Cuba, Kennedy's presented with more options because he knows exactly what is, not exactly, but he has a great idea of what's there because of the satellites. He can see in Cuba the exact same structural layout that they see for nuclear sites in Russia from their satellites. And so these various tests that are polluting the environment through radiation or through the debris is actually degrading the ability to do this. So there's an interaction that's happening. Polluting the environment hurts our ability in other ways. So as the two interplay, I think is the theme he's trying to pull out here and saying that preserving our environment is in our best interest.
To kind of wrap up here before we move on to our critiques, again, I had really enjoyed this idea of the environment being one of the bridge, if you will, again, between politics and technology because the politics, administrations change, regimes change. You flip between these different thought processes, space nationalism, global institutionalism, what have you. The technology, as we've talked about, is constantly evolving and it's moving at a pace that we haven't really seen before. So the environment kind of bridging these two things together, which helps determine whether we would prefer to cooperate or compete, is really great, which I think he brings us forward in his hypothesis that he mentions that more enduring cooperation occurred in areas of space activity where higher degrees of environmental interdependence existed. And the way he describes it is that there was none in areas of science. It was encouraged in utilities, but it happened a lot in military applications, that there was just a need for environmental interdependence between the two, as you mentioned, Badger, between like we don't want to frag out satellites that we need for treaty verification because that reduces uncertainty and allows us to build trust as we try to limit our nuclear arsenals, going back specifically to the Cold War example. However, with that, I'll use that as a transition to critiques here. I do think that environmental interdependence as politics and technology changes, that actually starts to potentially go away, especially in military, as we talk about. Like he mentions his three big emerging trends. So SSA, space traffic control, communication, and geo slots, right? I think there's another emerging trend that's associated with these because it really, I think in my mind, relates to the increased number of players and desirability. But the advances in military technology utilizing space as an enabler and asymmetries that get created there, the environment was interdependent for military applications when we both, and I'm saying the U.S. and the Soviet Union, needed to use satellites for treaty verification. What happens to that environmental interdependence if I am in competition or conflict where, say, the U.S. has a massive relative advantage in terms of what I need to rely on the space domain for versus, say, a Russia or a China who maybe is not as reliant and doesn't see that environmental dependence the same way in terms of their military applications for space? He may hypothesize that it will reduce cooperation, but he says that in military applications specifically, that there is incentive for environmental dependence and cooperation. I don't know that I buy that in the current environment, but what do you guys think?
I think I agree with your argument. I think there's a danger there of conflating cooperation and competition, which is the realm in which Maltz is in, with conflict itself. I don't think that he would argue that this cooperation would exist or this preservation of the environment the space environment would persist throughout conflict. I think he's trying to scope his argument to cooperation and competition. And so I think there's a slippery slope there. While I agree with your argument, I think we have to be careful not to extend his argument into a realm in which he did not intend. Building off that, Brian, so help me understand a little better the difference between viewing this as a global commons, because that seems to be a very pivotal point for you. You've brought it up a number of times in class about how if we assume this is a global commons, then it changes our view. This perception of global commons, how does this affect the way in which Maltz approaches his argument with this underlying assumption?
Yeah, so Maltz's underlying assumption that space is a global commons, it's effectively a logic that says that all players in the domain gain more benefit playing in the domain than if they didn't have it. And so therefore, the domain should be protected to ensure everybody has access and opportunity to be able to do the things in space that they want to do, be it commercially or scientifically or whatever. My problem or my criticism on this is that the environment that Maltz describes has evolved from the Cold War in a way that makes it a little bit more nuanced and complex than I think he's giving it credit for.
So was it more global commons in the Cold War or more global commons now?
To the extent that it was global commons at all, I think it was probably more global commons in the Cold War because of the limited number of actors and because of the purposes through which they were using space. So the U.S. and Russia were using space for treaty verification, and they were using it to create an element of stability and a very tense and complicated nuclear standoff. So with the intelligence satellites that both sides had available, they could verify that their adversary is not doing anything overly nefarious or anything overly escalatory or preparing for some kind of mass raid scenario. And it worked really, really well when there were two superpowers that were using space primarily to stabilize a nuclear stalemate. Flash forward to today, and I think the domain is just way more complex than that. Yes, you have commercial actors, and I think Maltz does a good point saying that the commercial business interests are for safe and stable and secure. But what he doesn't address is how space-enabled kill chains have driven instability in the domain, like structural instability, and have incentivized weaponization. And so what I mean by that is that there's no longer this like clear breaking point between we either take space as a global commons or we trash the domain and no one can use it. Space weapons development has gotten a lot more precise and a lot more targetable, such that states can engage in counter space activity without developing the high debris count and the significant amount of radiation that Moltz describes as trashing the domain. So with these more precision capabilities that states have developed, they can target the space-enabled kill chains that states like the United States rely on to project power downrange. So if I'm playing an away game as the United States, I need satellites, I need space-enabled capability. An adversary can take away that, can take that away without trashing the whole domain, and that breaks Moltz's paradigm a little bit.
So can you juxtapose that? Because if I'm Moltz, I think I would look at you and be like, yeah, that's military restraint. You've made this more surgical, more precise. You're not trashing the domain, thus preserving the global commons, because yes, you are right that the domain has gotten more congested and complex, but it also provides way more services for the for everyone, right? We're talking SATCOM, internet, GPS, like all of those, they seem to lend towards his argument of space is a global commons because it doesn't just provide military capability now. And surgical weapons seem to provide, to your point, I don't have to trash the space domain, which could arguably be military restraint.
Yep. So in one sense, it absolutely is. And I think there's a little bit of a false dilemma that we've got going on here in that like space is either a global commons or it's an arena of competition and militarization, when the reality is, I think it's both. There is a global commons element where people stand, where states and actors stand to gain much from their use of space. However, at the same time, there is an element of instability and weaponization occurring below the threshold of trashing the domain. And we have to hold both those truths kind of simultaneously. And we actually saw a little bit of that in the book when Moltz talks about the duality of the Soviet rhetoric and actions during the Reagan administration. So their secretive space weapons programs was put into overdrive while simultaneously they were advocating strongly for space arms control. So it shows that like states can do two things at once, advocate for arms control and develop space weapons. And if the structural incentives exist for using weapons to deny space-enabled attack capabilities without destroying the global commons, then I think Moltz's book is a little bit remiss in not addressing it.
Well, so let's build off of that. One of the interesting things you brought up is the idea of this asymmetric thing that Yeti had brought up in our pre-discussion. The idea that asymmetry is created. You have these dominant space powers. One of the things that was happening between the Soviet Union and the U.S. is you're fairly close. Khrushchev is lying about it, but there's the perception that you're close. And so you end up with this military superpower one-upping, where as opposed to an asymmetric challenge, you end up with a completely different set of decisions. And so the incentive structure, if you're an asymmetric power, if I could just pollute the environment, I can trash everything up there, and now we're on a more equal playing field. If you're entirely, the U.S. is entirely dependent upon this space domain, and we've had so much capabilities up there, another power that's asymmetric and doesn't have that may wish to send the U.S. back to the space dark ages, so to speak, through a policy of actually intentionally polluting the environment.
But you don't even have to intentionally pollute the environment, and I guess that's where my comments on the characteristics of space weapons that he gets after. Because you don't have to intentionally pollute the environment. You just have to leverage the precision targeting of contemporary space weapons to include like the jammers, to include the laser dazzlers, and to include permanent kinetic effects. My big criticism here is that so Moltz assumes that the using weapons in space will necessarily trash the environment, but that's not true based on how space weapons have generated. And I guess to his point, states have restrained themselves from developing kinetic high debris ASAT technologies and then deploying them and using them. But we're seeing in the CSIS space threat assessment, what we're seeing is a lot of development of non-kinetic weapons with permanent and temporary effect. And so you don't have to thrash the environment to attack someone in space anymore, as you did during the Cold War period, where you're just launching ASATs either off of like F-15s or off of SM-3s in the middle of the ocean or through high altitude nuclear detonations like we saw in Starfish Prime. You can be a lot more precise and use a scalpel, not a cudgel, and attacking space. And I think that starts to incentivize actors to like take offensive actions in space that they wouldn't otherwise take in the context of the Cold War.
It's interesting. So that is a limitation to his argument, and it's kind of outlined in his counterfactual, right? Towards the beginning of the book, he outlines a counterfactual of it. With no restraint, we end up with this totally polluted environment, which seems to ignore the history of technology does adapt to the constraints, which would support his argument had he gone that direction. The way in which these kinetic weapons can pollute the environment has actually led to a different technological development, which is what you're identifying, the idea that we can actually create the effects we want without polluting the environment. So these non-kinetic or these non-debris producing effects. So I think that his argument is supported, although he doesn't go down that particular path.
Hey, I think, Brian, the question for you and I's critique that we might need to answer or at least justify is, do we think that given asymmetry and incentives to potentially take military action in space, but in a non-polluting, non-environmentally trashing way, is that military restraint or is it not? In the way that Moltz is discussing it, because I think Badger brings up a great point that is military restraint, or at least you can make the argument that it is military restraint because it's not trashing the environment, where I think I was more attacking, I think mutual interdependence is going to go down as asymmetries in space increase and reliance on one actor as opposed to another. I find it hard to address that aspect of it unless those asymmetric capabilities, permanent abilities that you mentioned, wind up trashing the environment through, say, satellite collisions or something like that.
I think that we need to take a little bit more of a nuanced perspective on things. And I hate the cliche, but we just need to be a little bit more nuanced about stuff. In one sense, states have restrained themselves from developing like high energy, high velocity, huge debris causing or radiation emitting weapons. So yes. And so in that element, that the development of that specific technology, states have restrained due to the environmental factors. And I think Moltz's argument holds. However, the incorporation of space-enabled kill chains into the undergirding weapons technology that powers the joint force today drives instability and incentivizes weaponization short of that, like, thrash the environment with debris and radiation threshold. And so as the technology has advanced and we can be more exquisite, more precise, and target space systems with less trashing the environment effect, the development of those technologies has been incentivized. And I think that's why we're seeing the results that we see in the CSIS threat assessment.
Okay. Well, with our critiques out of the way, let's go ahead and start making some connections to 665 and maybe the wider SAS curriculum writ large. I'll go ahead and start off. I'll reference Anya. I don't want to butcher her last name. And the Space Force stalemate, as she, I think, provides a logical argument of why we need to advance some of the global institutionalism, the Outer Space Treaty mechanisms involved internationally for space law. She articulates why that's important and offers a way with which to go about it. I think Moltz gives us a how that might come about, again, back to that political, environmental, and technological sinking that makes it a very nice companion piece. The other thing I really do like here, I think Moltz, although maybe it's not an intent, is he offers a analytical framework between his space nationalism, technological determinism, social interactionism, and global institutionalism that we could use to maybe place some of these other authors that we have read in context. So, for example, I would say Dolman and Klein fall into like a space nationalist bent. And again, these are, I should caveat that these are, as he describes them, Moltz, these are ideal types not seen purely in nature, if you will, but are just nice analytical bins. So Dolman and Klein may be less towards space cooperation, if you will, and more towards competition, whereas you start to see maybe more global institutionalism, for example, again, with Anya, who I brought up earlier, leaning more towards a cooperation and military restraint in space. But what other connections did you guys see?
I'd like to connect it maybe to the larger coercion deterrence literature. And one of the reasons that I find it so fascinating is we've talked a lot about the domain or the character changing in outer space and the way in which we utilize it. One of the dominant things there being the commercialization of it. And so if you tie that to the larger coercion deterrence literature that exists within the SAS curriculum, there's always discussion on mutual interests. And that's always a starting point on developing treaties, strategy in general, is how do I tie all these agencies, these institutions with different interests together? What is the common interest? And so by pulling out the environment and making that a forefront of his argument, he really creates this mutual interest that can be a cornerstone of any strategy going forward. And he uses the example of Antarctica and describes how the preserving the environmental piece down there is a significant point. And as we look at commercialization of space in the same way, commercial entities in space are going to want the same kind of restraints on polluting the environment that the nation states would want, right? So as we get this kaleidoscope of actors, which I believe is the term he uses, this kaleidoscope of actors in the space domain, it's not just the U.S. and the Soviet Union anymore trying to find this mutual interest. Now we have to find mutual interest among all these disparate players. And the environment seems to be a good cornerstone that can bring in a multitude of interests. And so I find that very useful going forward.
I think I'm going to zero in on Molson Bowen because I found them to be really interesting mirrors for each other. And when I say mirrors, what I mean is being a reflection, like being very, very similar, but paradoxically at the same time, total opposites. So Moltz says that space is a global commons and that U.S. and Soviet dynamic was defined originally by cooperation and not militarization based on the environmental factors of space and the mutual benefits that both glean from it. Bowen completely disagrees and says militarization was baked in from the beginning. And if we don't like deal with and address that in his book, his appropriately titled book, Original Sin, if we don't deal with that original sin, then we're never going to get to this place of stability, security, and egalitarianism in space. That to me was really, really interesting. And it shows, to Moltz's credit, how the different bins of thought can lead one on different paths. So Bowen seems to be, in Moltz's construct, a technological determinist that says militarization in space at the beginning has driven militarization in space through time. And if we ever want to do something about that, we have to address it and then intentionally break course and go a different direction. Where Moltz would say that the norms developments, because Moltz, I think, straddles the line between social interactionism and global institutionalism in his little framework, saying that norm development reinforced through treaties and multilateral forums can sustain and maintain this peaceful cooperation and coexistence in space that's characterized from the beginning. Both of them have the same goal of a stable, secure, peaceful, egalitarian space domain, but the means through which they get there are diametrically opposed because they're starting from different points of technological determinism versus like a social interactionism. I thought that was interesting.
And I will, to wrap up kind of some of the connections here, I'll return to everyone's favorite topic, IR. But you mentioned, treaties and regimes, because I had seen a little bit of Keohane and Kirshner come out in this book as well. His mention on learning, I really felt, was based off of reducing uncertainty in the effects in the environment. His initial case for cooperation in space was based off of learning and reducing uncertainty about what would happen if I set nukes off in space or I created space debris. And you could make an argument that as we would shift more towards space nationalism, it's because uncertainty in the environment increased, which I think, according to, say, Kirshner, would make sense. And you could look at the G.W. Bush administration as he talks about that tilt, where now we have violent extremist organizations and we've got rogue states popping up and we don't know what they're going to do in the space environment. So uncertainty gets created. We lean back away from military restraint. So I saw that. And then as you talk, the global institutionalism and some of these regimes that help reduce uncertainty, that made me think of Keohane, right? Like these regimes have lasted. Again, you could talk, I know the OST doesn't neatly fit into a regime, if you will, but those Cold War space regime has helped reduce uncertainty and carried forward. Although again, you can make arguments that it needs to be updated, but I saw that as well. And I think that ties into Moltz's point about cooperation, whether we want to build bilateral, multilateral regimes to help reduce uncertainty, cooperate, which is one of Keohane's big points. What regimes offer you is it reduces uncertainty and makes communication easier between parties. which I think will drive to my big takeaway from here, which is when we start to think about the space domain and we're talking about it, I think what Moltz would tell you and what I would agree with is you got to move beyond just the politics and the technology between this is, you know, what policy is for what we want to do in space. Here's the technology with which we're going to get after it. But we have to think about the effects in the space domain environment itself and what that is going to cause second, third order effects, not just to ourselves, but potentially to our allies, partners, and those we are competing against, and whether that is stabilizing or destabilizing.
Yeah, thanks, Eddie. I think one of my big takeaways here is that Moltz makes a really important constructivist contribution to an otherwise like realist curriculum that says the way that we go about dealing with conflicts in space matters, and it can't just all be about power and application of power and domination, but there has to be this element of multilateral coordination if we're ever going to see space become something that's not just the wild, like a Wild West wasteland. However, I do think Moltz misses one half of the realist argument, and that ultimately all of these things that Moltz is advocating for have to be backstopped by power. And you've got to look at the structural incentives that the space domain advocates. He deals with half of it really, really well. He deals with half of it that says commercial interests in space drive towards cooperation, some strategic stability factors in space drive towards cooperation, but there's also an entire litany of environmental factors and political factors in space that drive towards escalation and weaponization. Specifically in this regard, I'm talking about the incorporation of space-enabled kill chains. Moltz's analysis is an important contribution to how constructivist narratives can help ameliorate some of that, but ultimately his perspectives have to be backstopped with hard power in order to create a credible and realistic deterrent to states that would use counter space technologies below the threshold of environment trashing to deny asymmetric advantages in space.
Building off that, my big takeaway, although not his main point, as he focuses on these structural pieces, not only the environment, but is that individuals matter. So as he goes through his chronology of this, is how the leadership changes over time can bring a different view and a different prospect. You know, if the dominant factor was, in fact, the environment, then when we see Reagan or Bush or Gorbachev or Khrushchev or any of these individuals who made these violent changes, if that was the environment factor, we wouldn't see much of these swings, but we're seeing these swings. And as those swings happen, it's mostly dominated by decisions by individuals. So a significant point that jumped out to me was how, as they're moving towards the test ban treaty, the military is making decisions to hurry up and get in as many tests as possible. And they're doing this even throughout the Cuban Missile Crisis, which was terrifying. But we have individuals making decisions that are driving these nationalistic ideas. And so individuals matter and individual decisions matter. I find that fascinating. Again, not his main point, and I brought away a lot of my takeaways throughout the conversation, but I think that one is something that really is going to stay with me.
All right, guys. Well, I think that about wraps it up. It's great having a conversation with you guys, and we'll see you in the next block of SAS curriculum.